What I'm going to do is offer some simple historical reflections with a view to developing understandings of the situation of British Jews and Muslims in the present conjuncture. What I hope to do is shed light on questions such as, are Muslims the new Jew? As has sometimes been recently suggested, and so on. And what I argue somewhat discursively is that there are as many similarities as there are differences between their experiences. I also argue that it is a degree of historical amnesia, and that is at the heart of the construction of the tropes and discourses that Ben Gidley was flagging up. So just sort of in a sense, those five or six tropes that he did, perhaps you could keep those in mind. What I want to do is obviously say that multiculturalism today, for many, has become a dirty word. The current government insists Cameron's Munich speech last year is anything to go by, and that, and I'll sort of reiterate what Nasser was saying earlier, under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we have encouraged different cultures to live separate lives apart from each other and the mainstream. We have tolerated these segregated communities behaving in ways that run counter to our values. In other words, multiculturalism now takes the blame for the radicalization of Muslim youth and the phenomenon of homegrown terrorism, held responsible for the dangerous sense of alienation that supposedly builds among young people living in separate communities. 5 years earlier, in June 2006, almost 12 months after 7/7, obviously a key moment in terms of damaging multiculturalism's reputation, Tony Blair spoke at the ceremony held at Bevis Marks Synagogue to mark the 350th anniversary of the readmission of the Jews to England by Cromwell in 1656. In his words, throughout the years and since then, the community has shown how it is possible to retain a clear faith and a clear identity and at the same time be thoroughly British. As the oldest minority faith community in this country, you show how identity through faith can be combined with deep loyalty to our nation. Implicit in his comments was the advice to British Muslims to follow this model community. He was able to do this, as politicians seem to do frequently, through historical erasure, leaving out a whole history of conflicted relations between the British state and society on the one hand and the Jewish community on the other. Not dissimilar to Muslims. For instance, like Muslims from the late 20th century, and Jews too in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were widely viewed as an alien religious community antagonistic to British society. They too were seen as a source of political subversion, terrorism and revolutionary violence, a threat to national security. Their loyalty too was questioned, and they too were repeatedly challenged politically to renounce other Jews. Like Muslims, a century later, when their demeanors were put down to the nature of Islam, the virulently negative stereotyping of Jews came out of Christian contempt for Judaism. Like Muslims, immigrant Jews were perceived to be backward, uncivilized, unassimilable, and prone to political radicalism and violence. In the press and parliament, they were accused of sympathy and connections with terrorism abroad. Russian Jewish immigrants in Britain were all potential agents of world revolution who might unleash terror at any moment. During the First World War, the anti-war movement, borne out by the reluctance of Russian-born Jews to fight on the same side as the Tsarist Empire, made them the target of widespread opprobrium. Fast forwarding to 1946-47, in the context of a later conflict, British Jews were suspected of aiding Zionist terror in Palestine, and it was feared that Jews may become a party to it within Britain. The state opening of Parliament in November 1946 was accompanied by intense security to deter Jewish terrorists. MI5 warned the government that Jewish underground groups in Palestine were planning to launch attacks on targets in the UK. A few months later, the Sunday Times challenged British Jews to denounce Jewish terrorism in Palestine. 1 year later, on the August bank holiday weekend, mobs incensed by atrocities against British troops in Palestine smashed up synagogues and Jewish-owned shops and desecrated cemeteries in Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow, and East London. In reaction, some young Jews, like their Muslim counterparts today, were attracted by radical movements which offered not simply faith, but an alternative ideology, a sense of belonging, solidarity, and a means of political mobilization. So, similar to some British Muslims confronting British security forces at home and abroad more recently, during the post-Second World War conflict in Palestine, British Jews overtly or covertly worked with Zionist underground in Palestine and in Europe, some joining armed units. So the image of a Jewish community distinguished by civic service, loyalty, and rectitude that Tony Blair painted in disingenuously, I might add, ignores the Jewish experience, which uncannily parallels, albeit, and I think this is important, in a different context, that of British Muslims. Nevertheless, despite the challenges facing them, the Jewish community was able, by the early decades of the 20th century, to achieve a substantial measure of civic and religious equality, not, if it must be acknowledged, without prolonged negotiations. And so have British Muslims. But concessions made to the latter seem to have met with much greater resistance and opposition than those made to the former. Jewish cultural and religious claims, ritual slaughter, Jewish schools, and the rabbinical courts, Sunday trading, dress codes, seem to have been accepted without a great deal of protest. But when Muslims began to make analogous demands, halal meat, Muslim schools, recognition of Sharia councils, arranged marriages, the hijab, these were accompanied by controversy and indeed quite intensely charged resistance. Why? Perhaps because in the more religious context of Victorian and Edwardian Britain, Jewish demands were seen as reasonable. In the more secular framework of the late 20th century, and they have been perceived as running counter to the liberal values of British society. So, while the processes at work in reaching these accommodations are similar, the reactions seem to have been quite different. Perhaps it was because Jews in the 19th century Britain pursued an explicitly assimilationist strategy of Anglicization, in which Judaism played no role in the public sphere. This rendered them relatively invisible and their ethno-religious claims less exposed to contention. But all this happened in the absence of any form of multiculturalism. Indeed, initially, multiculturalism, when it did first appear on the agenda in the 1960s, was introduced precisely as a response to the failure of assimilationism in regard to the education of immigrant children. More broadly, from the 1970s, it came to be accepted positively as an effective strategy for managing the emerging diversity in British society. By the 1990s, the backlash against multiculturalism had begun. The 2001 disturbances in England's northern towns were blamed on decades of multicultural policies. In right-wing philosopher Roger Scruton's view, multiculturalism was a recipe for disintegration. To Yasmin Ali Bhai Brown, the discourse of multiculturalism no longer offered a shared narrative of who the British are today. In the words of Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, mentioned already by Nasser, this was not a multicultural Britain, but a kind of plural monoculturalism, a Britain composed of separate cultures coexisting rather easily, side by side, in effect, living apart together. But when we look at the post-1945 evolution of British society, while we do see ethnic segregation, I would suggest that it is not evident that the policies of multiculturalism are its primary cause. Ethnic residential concentrations were the consequence of mass immigration of primarily manual workers into inner city industrial zones. Subsequently, these demographic patterns were exacerbated more by fear of racism and white flight than by self-ghettoization. Research shows that all minorities, including Muslims, want to live in mixed neighborhoods, and ghettos are created by those who move out. Moreover, contrary to the belief that segregated neighborhoods breed intense religious and cultural identities, and such communities should be dispersed to form ethno-religiously mixed neighborhoods, recent studies suggest that for Muslims more than non-Muslims, when other demographic and socioeconomic characteristics are kept constant, intense identities are more prominent in relatively mixed neighborhoods. The Labour Party's adoption of community cohesion as a response to the 2001 disturbances, which was designed to bring diverse and mutually hostile communities together, did not prove successful, mainly because this policy of community cohesion did not address structural inequalities and disadvantages rooted in the material processes and conditions that seem to underlie the antagonism between communities. Indeed, the sources for their separation may be more credibly located in what was the growing media-filled Islamophobia evident in wider society, as well as a British foreign policy that many British Muslims perceive as inimical to Islam, and also the undeniably draconian measures introduced by the Labour government to combat Islamist terrorism. As we all appreciate, the terrorist attacks in New York, 9/11, and particularly since 7/7 in London, it placed multiculturalism under tremendous criticism. The fact that the UK has produced some homegrown jihadist terrorists has been widely deployed as ammunition in the battle against multiculturalism. Hence, Michael Nazir Ali, Bishop of Rochester, tells us that multiculturalism is to blame for perverting young Muslims. Canon Malik likewise asserts that multiculturalism has fanned the flames of Islamic extremism. And William Pfaff argues that these British bombers are a consequence of a misguided and catastrophic pursuit of multiculturalism. According to Gilles Kipel, British multiculturalism had been smashed to smithereens. With the impetus for all these events and responses being terrorism, it is questionable whether all or indeed any of these comments genuinely engage with multiculturalism, or whether it is the problem within Britain's multicultural society with which they were rather more concerned. While multiculturalism, or whether it is, such as critics argue on the surface at least, elevates difference and therefore enhances segregation, what underpins and clearly informs their argument and provides legitimization is the insistence upon the problems, perceived or otherwise, of Britain's Muslims. Consequently, they are viewed as something of a Trojan horse, embodying much malignancy, requiring a robust response. As Rod Little put it, it is Muslims and Islam, by attacking us, who we are, what we stand for, our way of life and our culture, by failing to integrate and assimilate, who are undoing and ultimately killing multiculturalism. Such comments, however, only seem to deepen the confusion, as they homogenize and essentialize us, as well as Islam and Muslims. What is often neglected in debates regarding Muslim demands is any awareness of the historic compromises that were arrived at between organized religions and European states, the stability pacts that were made between the majority churches and Judaism, and secularizing European states in the course of 20th century adjustments to universal suffrage and constitutional reforms. A look at European history tells us that Christian heritage has profoundly shaped and continues to shape Europe's vocabulary, self-understanding, institutions, and practices. It needs to be reiterated that religion has continued to play an important part in the European public imagination and behavior. churches are publicly supported and their ritualistic services consumed. While the religious historical roots may have been forgotten to some degree, religion continues to survive, albeit increasingly as culture, with many of the aspects retaining religious undertones. Thus, ongoing conflicts in Europe today are not necessarily or automatically due to the unwillingness of Muslims to accept secular norms, since the norms and policies are themselves not necessarily secular, though this reality is rarely, if ever, publicly acknowledged. If we accept these developments, then it would be clear that Muslims pose no particular problems. They are simply a new interest group and a new constituency, and European political systems should change to incorporate Islam as they did in respect of other religions in the past. Indeed, Muslims are asking for no more than to be accommodated within the existing structures, though this would require some rethinking as the continued assertion of Christian values tends to marginalize them rather than include them as equal citizens. Nevertheless, many questions remain. To what extent do we need similar values, norms, and symbols to form a harmonious society? Are Muslim practices at odds with Western values? Are diverse identities a threat to the stability and cohesion of modern nation states? How valid are the allegations of isolationism, separatism, and conspiratorial disregard for British norms and values, which continue to be leveled against Muslims? The last question becomes particularly relevant in view of the specific accusations that Muslims invoking multiculturalism's separatist principle refuse to share British values of tolerance and freedoms of expression and protest. This is mere speculation, since there is no evidence to suggest that the overwhelming majority of Muslims are otherwise predisposed. However, there is something else that is happening here. When Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, and David Cameron want everyone to share the common culture and their values, something that British politicians, irrespective of party affiliation, have been stressing in recent years, in reality, they're all implicitly asserting the supremacist character of their project and similarly setting aside the possibility of it being challenged or indeed being transformed in the process. This stance of the establishment is necessary in order to sustain their political power. If culture is about plurality, power is about unity. Multiculturalism is a threat because the state that we have depends upon a tight cultural consensus so as to deflect attention from the sources of social divisions and conflicts produced by material inequalities. Its instinct is to suppress conflict, maintain social cohesion, and more importantly, social order, through consensus on moral values and practices that it hopes would deliver conformity. Multiculturalism, on the other hand, is intrinsically conflictual. Many of today's critiques of multiculturalism are politically motivated and hermeneutically loaded codes for cultural assimilation and socio-political domination. However, if state assimilationism is no longer a viable option in today's Britain, then we might ask whether cultural hegemony in the public space could be attainable. This is what Cameron and more recently the Conservative Party chairman, Baron Savarsi, has been arguing for, arguably in terms of religion. While Varsi is prepared to concede that, and I quote her, people need to feel stronger in their religious identities, more confident in their beliefs, this is a nod in the direction of multiculturalism, her view is that the best way to encourage social harmony is to put Christianity at the center of public life, thus reasserting the hegemonic status of the Church of England. But for many, she is naive in her thinking. As Giles Fraser points out, defending Christianity as a vital part of our national identity, easily becomes code for defending Britain against Muslims. Behind Cameron's speeches, with Warsi acting as his useful fool, and those of Blair and Brown before him, lies nostalgia for a strong national collective identity, a Britishness with the Church of England providing the glue. However, this kind of Britishness has always been a hierarchical identity differentiated by race, ethnicity, religion, gender, class, and region. It remains contested because, as Mary Hickman has explained, I quote her here, identity politics and a politics of recognition flow from the contradictions that exist between the ideas of equality written into constitutions or articulated in notions of citizenship and the practices and politics that characterize everyday realities. So, a Britishness to which all can belong as equal citizens, as Tariq Mawdood would like, requires a reformulation and reimagining, and that would necessitate a shift from the deeply embedded hierarchical values of empire, monarchy, and the established church to which the power-wielding establishment is unequivocally wedded. Highly unlikely. Indeed, the rhetoric of anti-multiculturalism, in my view, seeks to distract political attention away from fundamental socioeconomic problems and divisions that face deprived minority and majority ethnic communities alike, and which are actually caused by their material circumstances, competition for jobs, housing shortages, inequitable access to health, education, welfare, and social services. By refracting resentments and frustrations into ethnic conflict, David Cameron's rejection of multiculturalism represents an attempt to suppress potential challenges to the ideological hegemony of neoliberalism in maintaining the current social order. So finally, to end, if you like, on a note of optimism, at least for those who see it as a public good. The irony is that despite this assault, multiculturalism has actually continued to expand in government policy. The coalition government, for instance, is explicit in its promotion of new faith schools and the Big Society agenda, both of which look likely to encourage further ethno-religious communitarian tendencies. Multiculturalism lives on, albeit in new guises. Thank you.